Welcome back to Anything But a One, Adventures in Historical Miniature Wargaming. With nearly 100 years of combined game experience, you'd think they'd be smarter. Anyway, here's Tom Castaños, Richard Martinez, and Ray Winstead.
Welcome back to Anything But a One, Adventures in Historical Miniature Wargaming. Chantel, thank you for that lovely introduction. We are not smart. She's correct. My name is Tom Castaños, Ray Winstead, Richard Martinez here. Remember to like and share the podcast. Rate us 5 stars if you can. And you can support the podcast on our Buzzsprout.com webpage by clicking the heart, which is buying us a beer. Or you can get on Patreon and look us up at patreon.com/ABA and the number one. Every little bit helps. Podcasting is not free, so we appreciate your support. Today we're going to start something where we're hoping to do a series of these episodes, and it's about, maybe it's for new gamers and maybe it's for longtime gamers that have just never played a particular time period. But there's a lot of things to consider when you decide, I'm going to try XYZ. Like, what are the rules that are available? Are there lots of rules available? Am I getting in over my head? Is there great research available? What kind of miniatures are in stock? Scale, all kinds of things by time period. So we're going to start with the obvious one. Doug Glover, you can put this on pause and go get a beer because I know this is not your cup of tea. But we're going to talk a little bit about starting Napoleonics. And this maybe it's apropos as Warlord has done their epic Waterloo, and that's expanding every time I turn around. Now they have little epic Prussians, and you know, I guess there's thought that it will move beyond the 100 days at some point. And with the ability to 3D print miniatures, even though Warlord decided to go with their goofy ass scale, nothing stopping you from printing your other miniatures, your 3D files in 12.5 millimeter. So we're going to talk a little bit about what it takes to get into Napoleonic gaming. Rich, do you want to like kick this off? I mean, how do you want to go with this?
Sure. I don't mind. I don't mind starting up a topic. What does it take to get into Napoleonic wargaming? One of the first things that I remember coming up in my mind was all the research that it takes to do the uniforms. That was something that I won't say it seemed daunting to me, but unlike when you paint generic, ancient infantry where there is no color code, you just paint them the way you want them. Right, exactly. Flesh and brown. Yeah. There is a very specific way to paint the armies you're trying to recreate. Right. And a big part of that is knowing, what colors to use and, and get the facings and pipings. And I remember spending a lot of time looking up at books to know how to get my guys just right. I couldn't go out there with my pink coats and, red pants and say, okay, I'm ready to fight as the French.
But, you see that on Facebook posts all the time about, like, did I paint these right? And at least by the third comment, what is the answer? Well, it's your army. Paint it any way you want.
Paint it any way you want.
Which makes my OCD hurt a little bit when it comes. but in fairness, this has been a
the time. Only thing is, and it should be pointed out, if you do that, expect a lot of very cranky old men
like me
to yell at you because you followed the advice and painted them the way you want.
Right.
And as much as I'd like to think I would never like chastise anyone for that, and it would not be about facing color at all, but I mean, if you decided, the British don't look good in red, that would
pretty
bug me.
Basic, yeah.
That would bug me. I've got to admit, I'm that guy to some degree.
Yeah, I would agree that you can definitely go down too many rabbit holes. I'm talking about some basic standards.
Sure. Yes.
British red coats, the French were the blue, unless they were white uniforms.
Or if you came to the game ready to play and said, I don't have a British army, my stand-in are going to be these guys, I'm okay with that too. Totally okay with that. I mean, yeah, in a perfect world, we'd have every single little unit that's represented on the table, but I'm not that big a douche canoe. I would let you, you know, substitute as long as, you know, and I see this even in like bolt action things like, well, I've got like Americans for D-Day, but I want to play a North Africa. It's like, oh, bro, you got Americans. You're golden, man. Yeah, plus, they're Americans. The equipment doesn't change ever.
Right.
The organization changes a little bit, you know, but I would never beat somebody up for that, or you're using your Blitzkrieg Germans for, you know, you got Germans, you're in.
Or like me, my, you know, Flames of War, I got my winter Germans.
Yeah,
I use them any time of the year.
That's right.
They got the little mittens on just
in
case.
Look, they're just cold
nature. Yeah. Exactly.
Just cold. They're cold. They're Ray.
So they go South Africa.
Yeah. They go too far.
Those
people
nights are cold.
Take that too far.
Those nights in Africa are cold. Right. What do you think, Ray? What's something that you would help / warn people about?
Hey, things to expect. It's if you're getting into Napoleonics, depending on what. First of all, expect that there are a lot of different niches in Napoleonics. You can do everything from skirmishing with very small units all the way up to entire battles of multiple corps, and you've got just about everything in between, and you're going to find a lot of different rules that cover just about all of those different elements. Napoleonics, what people consider Napoleonics, covers a lot of time from, you know, late 1700s all the way up into, you know, 1815 more or less. So it, and there's a lot of different fashions and styles and modes of warfare changes quite a bit during those time periods, which affects all the rules.
Yeah.
So you're going to find a lot of different rules out there. You're going to find a lot of different scales out there.
Well, that's where I was going to go next. I was going to say, you know, globally, and we've had this discussion before too about is miniature wargaming more of a deal in England than it is in the United States, and Rob Wubenhorst has a belief that no, we're just more spread out in the United States, probably just as many if not more doing the gaming, but there's so much space in between versus the little pub in every English town where they're playing. But my point in this is probably to this day the single most popular military miniature wargaming is probably Napoleoni. There's probably in every corner of the world, there's someone doing this. And that means there's 7 zillion sets of rules, which when we started was worse for the gamer than it is now, because something you don't experience as much anymore is that your figures must be mounted a certain way and must have so many figures on a base. More rules than not now are rather basing agnostic, as long as everyone's based the same.
Mm-hmm.
When we changed rules back then, it meant soaking little figures off of bases and prying them up and remounting them, because you simply couldn't play the game if not. So when we had a billion set of rules back in the 80s, it meant a nightmare amount of work. Now, not as much. You are able to sit down. I want to try that game. You can try it with your figures the way they're mounted.
You know? Ironically, you say that, but yeah, you just went through a rebasing project.
I did, and it wasn't a. It was a labor of love. We didn't need
to.
We played the game
without it
with the other basing, but we realized how much easier it would be if.
Correct.
Had it.
Correct.
Plus, a lot of those figures you initially based back in the 80s.
In the 80s.
It's time for an update.
it was weird to look at figures that I know that I painted and based literally like when Reagan was president. I mean, that's a pretty interesting concept of how long you've been doing this. So don't be intimidated by the fact that there are so many rules. I think one of the most interesting aspects, and I got the opportunity to chat with some amazing Canadian gamers not too long ago, and one of the things that they thought was the biggest selling point of a set of rules is how many people are playing it, because they wanted to be able to go from place to place and mm-hmm. play with new people that were all playing, you know, whether it be a Black Powder or an Age of Eagles or whatever it is. So, you know, finding consensus is difficult in this world, but there still are some big three, big four games that more people are playing than not.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're first getting into it, that's something to consider. What are the people in your area playing? Will you get an opportunity to go right. watch people play and then sit in when you have, you know, before you have miniatures, maybe somebody will let you play a brigade of theirs, and then eventually you go and paint your own. So look around where you are and see what's being played.
Yeah. And I think.
And in what scale?
Yeah. That's an important thing. I think it's important if you're going into Napoleonics, you need to decide what level of game you want to play. You know, do you want to be a marshal, or do you want to be Sharp leading his little band of riflemen around?
Yep.
Because that's going to have a profound effect on what rules you play and everything else around the game. So you've really gotta kind of have a pretty clear idea of where you want to go, because that's going to decide your available rule sets. I think you also need to understand that if you just go on most Facebook pages, if you're considering getting into it, and ask, what are the best set of rules, you're going to get 30 different answers.
Yep.
And every one of those answers is going to be very passionate about why.
Yes.
Those are the best.
Don't play those. Those are crap.
Yes. just kind of roll with the punches. you know, try to take in what they're saying. But be aware that Napoleonics seems to bring a very passionate crowd
right.
about the war game. It is something that the people who do it take very seriously.
Well, and let's go back to my comment about the British soldiers in purple coat kind of thing. That's a part of my passion, right? I love the research of all of the uniforms. Mm-hmm. So if you just blatantly decided, nope, I'm doing them camouflage, that's going to make my teeth hurt, you know, and I'm going to be a little bit of that guy. You know, I'm not going to bust your chops if you were trying your best and you didn't quite get it right. And, you know, look, there's a lot of stuff I painted years ago that I've since realized I didn't do right. You know, it's a learning process.
You're not going to penalize them for not getting like the hidden copy of Funkin's book that's, you know, printed in 1991 and exactly. not print for 30 years.
Exactly. That everybody now says was wrong. Right. And you're going to get jumped on by half the people. Yeah. Yes.
But having said that, you know, it is part of the appeal of this particular kind of gaming. And I've found that in games, all right, let's go English Civil War. My first intuition as I started studying this was, nobody really knows how these guys were dressed. And that's my American, all my English friends who just grasped their chest. You know, it's
like, till you go to England,
right?
And everybody knows what color bows they wore.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes,
the information was not readily available to me at my fingertips in my library in 1991. I know now online I can go to the Sealed Knot Society and find out exactly what it was, but because that was not my primary point of focus, I didn't have any problem with people having their very ununiformly painted pike and shot units. So a lot of it has to do with what you know and your comfort zone. If you know World War II inside and out, then maybe the P-dot camouflage makes you mad in North Africa or whatever. But if you're not, well, you got a German soldier, that's okay. So I would think that something like World War II and something like Napoleonic will draw the most immediate ire from people about those specifics and things mm-hmm. like that. So let's talk about scale. And you started to touch on this. You can play Sharp. And a lot of people love that game. And if you're talking about an entry-level game, some of these skirmish games, not necessarily Sharp practice. That still takes quite a few.
That's quite a few
miniatures.
Yes.
But Chosen Men, the, you know, the Osprey Blue Book, mm-hmm. you know, you can get by with 20, 20, 30 figures. And most people can paint 20 or 30 figures, except Ray, that and get a game going. But if you're going, but if you did, and I think more people think of themselves as Napoleon than Richard Sharp, there's going to be
a steep entry cost
for this, right?
Yes. Yeah, number of castings to be painted.
And you're also going to have to consider that if you're wanting to be Napoleon, you're going to have a hard time doing that in 28 millimeters unless you live next door to the Perrys.
Yeah. You never play on anything less than a 10
or have a club or a very large space with a lot of friends who are interested in the same game.
Right.
I'm not going to say it can't be done, but you're going to have a very difficult time pulling it off.
So I think back when we very first started and we bought our miniatures at Dibble's Hobby, still in town, still open, still sells game miniatures for that matter. Mm-hmm. And they would have these big Empire 2 and Empire 3 games, and they'd have four or five people playing, which is how you get a big game, really.
Right, right. Everybody brings their stuff.
But because there are so many options in the Napoleonic Wars, do you remember what the Allied army always was? The Austro-Prussian, Russian, Westphalian, Italian, Swedes?
British, Prussian, Russo, Swedo-ish.
Because everybody ran off to their corner and they painted a core of what they liked.
Exactly what they liked.
That was going to be my point. You know, aside from skill is one thing, and deciding what skill you want to play, one big expectation is, can you nail down a period of time that everyone wants to play in? Because that game you described over at Dibble's was just ahistorical. It's just a bunch of mosh pit of miniatures that you played.
Yep.
Normally.
That sums it up pretty well.
I mean, yeah, it was just everybody under the sun. But if you've got four people in your group and one person paints British, one person paints French, one person paints Russians, and one person paints Austrians, if you're trying to recreate historical games, two of those guys aren't ever going to bring their stuff to the game board.
Or you're going to have to be very comfortable proxying armies all of a sudden, somebody they own.
Your Austrians but became Westphalians.
If you're always proxying, I mean, then hell, you just should have painted the damn army the way it was anyway.
Right.
So, I mean, that works really for one-offs, but I'm talking about for sustained games that are always playing. If you never get to play your British as British, what's the point of painting the British?
If you want to paint everything but British, you know, you can do 1812, 1813, 1814.
Which is what we always delegate it down to, because the others were always limiting.
Yeah. And then if you want to limit it and you want to do the peninsula, then it's just Spanish and Portuguese and British and French and all, and a good number of French allies. It's actually an excellent choice for a beginner because the battles aren't huge.
Right.
It's not a lot of cavalry, and a lot of people, including myself, are not that crazy about painting horses. So it's probably one of the reasons that so many of these gamers use the peninsula. Because, first of all, it's probably a pretty good game in 28 because it's not a huge, huge game if you're going to do that 28. If the siren call of 28 millimeter, that's what I'm beginning to think of as 28. So magnificent.
And I would say 28 millimeter works very well for Napoleonics, but you got to really kind of set your expectations of what you're going to be able to put on the table.
Or you're playing in a club that has lots of stuff.
Yes. You know, you got to kind of be realistic about, you know, that 4x8 table or 4x6 table, you know, at the game store is probably not going to hold a core worth of 20, no matter what game rules you're playing.
Right. That's right. You're going to at least two tables, right? Now that Richard's retired, he can paint all that.
Yeah, we'll see how good that works. But to your point about the peninsula, and that works great for French allies, but not so great for the other side.
True.
Right? Unless you're painting British, Portuguese, or Spanish.
Yeah.
I got Prussians and Russians and Austrians, and they're shut out. They're shut out of that situation. So,
but that's not significantly. You know, this is a podcast for historical miniature wargaming for a reason. And that's not untrue of most other time periods, too. I mean, you know, you're fighting, you know, you've got your Republican Romans and Gauls or what, you know, you're not going to get everybody in that game either. Have you painted exclusively one kind of thing, you know? And again, how picky are you? Will you play your Imperial Romans as your Republican Romans?
Right.
Does that make your skin crawl? they got little feathers sticking off their helmets right. or don't, you know.
I'm okay
but,
with
but
that.
I think
yeah. I would be too.
I think you're probably not going to face the type of discrepancies when you pick a two-sided fight like that. No, I mean, like the one we're trying to recreate, right?
Yeah.
Roman invasion of Britain.
Yeah.
You got Celts, you got Romans. I mean, yeah. what else are you going to choose from?
True.
You know, I mean, that's it. Yeah. You've only got two sides to pick from.
Yeah.
And you have many more sides and many more time periods that don't fit that. The one that comes closer to that to me is like if you do World War II. Right, and you're doing someone paints Russians, and there's no other Russian front unit. The other guys paint other Allied troops, and you're going to be out too
yep.
in those situations.
Yep,
it's just because there's so many sides to represent,
mm-hmm.
which is why it's, if you can get on board, although it's easier said than done, on a single campaign, that would be the expectation is pick one campaign. It never works that way.
No.
Like you said, everybody devolves to picking what their favorite. Perceived troop was.
Or pick a rule set that allows you to not have to have a super high figure count so that you could have multiple, you know, in other words, if you're going to play Sam Mustafa's Blücher and you're a group of four or five, you paint your little core of units of you know, Austrians or whatever. It's not that big a deal to paint a little core of Spaniards too. You know, you're not Your commitment to the number of miniatures you're painting is not as high.
Right.
So that gives you that opportunity to pick and, you know, to go across the campaigns a little bit.
So that goes to my next point. If we can transition to the next one. Another expectation when playing Napoleonics is after you've played your main faction for some period of time, it's not uncommon that you paint multiple factions
right.
to play.
That's right. And
yep.
And if you're smart about that, you spread them out to where they cover different campaigns. Or if you're dumb like me, they're all in 1809, right? By Bavarians and Austrians.
Painful lessons from many years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
go ahead. I was going to say, and here's something that I don't know how often it gets overlooked, but it certainly got overlooked in our group. If you are playing with a group and you have a fixed group of people playing, make sure at least one player is willing to paint French because it is yeah. really hard to get a Napoleonic game campaign going if nobody is doing French.
That's
because early on, Tom decided to do the Austrians. I was doing the British/Dutch. Richard was doing Saxons. Yep. And suddenly we woke up and realized
that's right.
we had nobody playing the French.
Napoleonic Wars with no. Well, and in fairness, we had a former member that painted a ton of French. And then when he moved, the Napoleonic Wars ended.
Peace was declared.
Napoleon left, right?
Yeah. He Napoleon relocated.
It almost happened in our American Civil War,
almost.
Too, because he was also the Union Army.
That's right.
Thankfully, well, that was somebody also, bought that army from him. But
that was also the feeling that the French were kind of cliche.
Yeah.
And you know, everybody wanted to do these exotic, different looking, you know, people wanted to do something that wasn't blue.
But right. the reason it's cliche is because it's necessary because and the most common
it's
thing
the
you would
central
see.
Element of the game.
Right.
So it seems like it should be obvious, but it does get overlooked.
I think I spent one winter and I painted the entire Waterloo Order of Battle and Age of Eagles. And then we finally had all the French we needed again.
Yeah.
But again, okay, so now there's where I'll fudge. My little 1809, my little 1815 Frenchmen have stormed all the Austrian 1809 battlefields and will easily storm into Spain with their 1815 flags. I'm not that
crazy. Well, I mean, same thing with like trying to do. Like, I have all the water. I have a set of the Waterloo British. I have no hesitancies using them in Spain. No.
And that is an important point too. You need to ask yourself how particular you're going to be at proxying troops from a given time period to a different time period,
yep.
because styles and fashions changed. Some cases kind of radically during the Napoleonic period.
Yeah.
So are you going to be okay using troops from Waterloo if you're playing in the peninsula,
yeah,
which can make a big difference. Some of those uniforms looked very, very different.
Yeah, from cavalry and bicorns to
I'll
comment on this.
If you're going to do 1815, understand that most of those uniforms in 1815 apply to a very small number of battles. There's just not a lot to draw from for that particular set of uniforms.
But I'll preface it.
So they're probably the least flexible.
This comment, though, is that they may look very different, not from 4 feet away in the game table.
I would say
that depends on the person who's looking at them. Because I remember a Napoleonic game breaking down over the color of some buttons on some uniforms.
Not our game.
None of our games. Well, we would not.
That's going too far.
I was there. But those rabbit holes exist.
Yeah.
And there are those people who...
And that's the one thing to expect. There'll be some people that are like that.
And this is the thing that's going to be universal. If we do more in this series and do different time periods, be careful who you game with. It doesn't matter what your time period is. Don't game with that guy.
That's right. Time to uninvite someone.
I think that's a universal truth.
That's the same guy that, that's a Ost A versus an Ost D Panther. It's a Panther tank. Look, bro, I didn't roll out a Sherman and call it a Panther tank. Leave me alone.
It's good enough.
You know? That's a welded hull versus a cast hull.
Because knowing our styles, is like we like playing and dabbling in different time periods. It would be, I don't know any of us that would want to paint an entire army for 1815 British and then turn around and recreate the same number of battalions in 1809 British.
Doing British, I'm doing 1850. I'm doing 1815 British, and they are going to be quite happy in the peninsula.
That's what
or
I said.
They're not going to play.
Or, that's right.
Or in Maryland in 1812. I mean, they'd be perfectly fine for that too.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
Perfectly fine. So certainly another thing I would add to this, and we've kind of bounced
a lot of topics.
But scale. I mean, we've all said, everybody at this table has said, if this was 1982 again, and there were 6 mil miniatures out there, we'd have millions of them.
Yes.
Absolutely, I think, millions.
Yeah, I would agree.
I'd have Borodino in 18, in 6 mil, because you can.
Right.
I mean, financially you can. When you learn how to paint 6 mil miniatures and you quit thinking they're 28s, you can paint them very quickly.
Okay, well, I haven't quite got to that point
yet. Yeah, you can paint them. You can dry brush the hell out of them and make some really nice looking miniatures. I would have massive armies. I would have a peninsula and an 18 in an army where you really couldn't tell whether it's a stovepipe check or whatever.
Those ones wouldn't be able to tell. And you know, you preface that, I think, along with that comment in 1983, if we had those choices, it'd be choice of miniatures, of course, and, of course, choice of rules, because we didn't have rules in 1983 that would have taken advantage of that scale set.
You know what? We would have played it. No, I said we could have gotten to the size of game that Scott Bowden wanted, but I can't imagine individual skirmish castings in 6 mil.
Yeah, no, it was very specific in how you had to mount his guys, and it wouldn't work.
Little skinny stands of 6 millimeter.
Right. You had to make up your own game.
maybe we would have been way ahead of our time with that. Mm. But in a sense, we did do that because we used the smallest, least expensive miniatures available at the time.
At the time.
Yeah. Which was 15 mil.
That were at least presentable. Because I think there were 6 millimeters around, but most of them looked like...
But they were, real...
Yeah, they looked like little nubs on...
Yeah, they were definitely in the periphery. Hell, I bought 3 mil.
And I think they were really hard to come by, too.
Well, I remember time in 1981, 82, 83, we were the counterculture because the standard was 25.
Right, Hinchcliffe 25. So, I mean, these are all things.
I remember taking a lot of grief for my 15s from certain crowds.
Yeah, that's right. And it's kind of funny now that 15s for a long time kind of fell out of favor, particularly in our group, and now they're coming back in spades because we've gotten some really nice games going. And it's nice that we have Richards.
We have it.
Looking, Richards once again saying he told us all along we were idiots. But, we have this stuff, right? So... You know, to summarize, entering the Napoleonics, for gaming, know what's being played in your area.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you intend to play solo all your life, which is, hey, nothing wrong with that.
Or paint both sides on your own.
Or paint both sides and con your Warhammer friends into playing your Prussians once in a while. Tell them it's a faction. Horus Heresy of Napoleonics. But and I actually don't even know what that means. So it's all heresy as far as I'm concerned. You know, so think about how much you want to paint. What kind of level of game do you want to be at? And a lot of these things are going to be the same. Like later on, if we do an episode about American Civil War, we'll say many of the same things, but whereas there are very specific units in the American Civil War,
mm-hmm.
the greater majority of people gaming American Civil War, I would, and maybe we get a whole bunch of abuse on what I'm about to say, is most of them do it more generically than that, particularly yeah, depending on what I rule size, particularly with things like epic scale coming out. You know, you might have a black hat brigade because they've got slouch hats versus kepis, but nobody's really counting out the 118th Pennsylvania versus the 124th Massachusetts. Right.
And I think that's one of the things that makes Napoleonics unique, is the passion that goes into those odd and unique uniforms. And a significant number of people really enjoy the idea of bringing those things to life in mm-hmm. miniature mm-hmm. to put them on the mm-hmm. table. And I don't think it exists in other genres, but I don't think it exists to the same level that it does in Napoleonics.
Something we talked about,
you
know, too.
You find a few people in Civil War that do it. Certainly in Ancients, you find a few mm-hmm, people sure. who take a great deal of pride in the level of detail they put. But for the most part, most people who paint Romans paint the stereotypical Roman in, you know, the later armor.
Right, traditional garb, right.
Yeah, they're traditional. And they just kind of go with that, whether they're Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you can, like you're saying, you can add that flair in a poem. It gives you license to then really explore those unit histories, those unique yes. uniforms. And for some people, that's a huge selling point.
It
not,
was for me.
For me, not so much. But yeah, I definitely see people.
I ate that up. Yeah. I was the guy that, you know.
Which I'll say this about it. Again, a detraction when we go back to scale. If you were to push it down to 6, you lose a lot of that.
You lose it. And that's
if you can stay at that battalion level, then you can explore to your heart's content all the different unique aspects of uniform design.
Well, yes, I took a great deal of pride in finding the most unique details mm-hmm. on every little guy in my British
and obscure armies. I'll add to your list.
Yes, I the only person I know that ever painted a complete Dutch army
yes.
for Empire.
We talked about this a little bit in our reevaluating episode a couple of episodes back, but I remember being really specific about, you know, that's the 12th West Prussian, you know, whatever, and making sure that my facings match the area of recruitment and all those kind of things. Then we moved to those games like Age of Eagles and Napoleon's Battles, where a unit was a brigade,
right?
And it didn't matter so much, you know, because if you were really getting down to it, other than Austrians, which were a huge unit, you'd have multiple different colors of facings in one set of stands mm-hmm. to represent the multiple regiments that made up that. So I quit caring about that. And now I've gone full circle that we're going back to kind of a battalion-based game.
Endless,
it kind of bugs me that I have mm-hmm. all of those different little, you know, I went back when I tried to remount stuff, I tried to group them back together as best I could into the same facing color. Same problem I had when we talked about black powder or 28mm Napoleonics. The Austrians, it's a white uniform. The only splash of color is the facing color. And yeah. when we were saying is a unit, because black powder can be anything you want it to be, is a unit a brigade or is a unit a regiment or is a unit a battalion, then that meant that these 36 guys that I painted would all have one facing color and the next 36 would have a different facing color if they were regiments. But now if they're battalions, I'm painting two, maybe three groups of 36 castings with all the same facing color. So at that scale where it's so visible, it did matter to me. And it bothered me a whole lot that we couldn't come to a consensus.
And that was the point where I think that was the strength of 15s. They were just big enough that you could make out those kind of details, but they were small enough you weren't overwhelmed.
Right. It didn't destroy your game aesthetic.
Paint a large number of them in a reasonable amount of time.
Yep.
And complete stuff, whereas 28s, that's a lot of work.
It is. It's a lot of work. And it's a lot of stuff for you to think about if you're going to enter into one of these. I mean, it's fun. First of all, you want to be having fun. But I think it's important to have a little bit of concept of what you might be getting into when you try one of these time periods. Talk with your local group if you have one. Mm-hmm. Get on Facebook and be ready to be bombarded because, again, this is a very popular time period with a lot of very passionate people, as Ray said. So hopefully this gave you some insight into entering the Polonics, or maybe just scared you off altogether and you went straight back over to Horace Heresy right now or whatever the hell that is.
There is one thing about research on uniforms, too. Just something to consider. And that's one of my passions is researching stuff and coming up with all these unique details. One of the things you're going to find is that no matter what you think is right, there is always going to be an argument somewhere that it's probably wrong. So nothing is ever absolutely right. But there are some things that are just absolutely wrong.
Right.
Probably.
If your coat's supposed to be white, you can argue about what shade of white it is. Oh, but you know, if it's black, it's freaking wrong.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Like, for instance, French blue. What color blue were the French coats?
Blue.
You know, you can just say they're blue, but I've seen endless arguments where people have argued endlessly over exactly what Bavarian blue.
The regulation says that this regiment only rode black horses. Like, that's until horses get shot. Then then you're on a donkey next, if necessary. I mean, there's a lot of that.
So just expect, no matter how much research you do, if you're one of those people that gets passionate about your painting and your uniforms, no matter how much effort you put into it, there will probably be somebody who will come along and point out that it's wrong.
So
just understand that there are some things that are definitely wrong, though.
So buy your favorite rules, get some miniatures, and get a huge bottle of Tylenol.
And some thick skin.
Yeah. Guys, thanks a lot. Chantel, take us out.
This has been Anything But a One, Adventures in Historical Miniature Wargaming. Subscribe on all major podcatchers and please rate and review us. You can support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/ABA1. patreon.com/ABA1. See you next time.